Mark Whitaker is the Executive Vice President and Managing Editor of CNN Worldwide, in charge of directing reporting and editorial content for America's largest global television network. He was previously the Washington Bureau Chief for NBC News and a reporter and editor at Newsweek, where he rose to become the first African-American leader of a national news weekly. His new book, My Long Trip Home, A Family Memoir, is a dramatic, moving work of historical reporting and personal discovery, tracing the story of what happened to his parents, a fascinating but star-crossed interracial couple. By the end, Mark arrives at a new understanding of the family dramas that shaped their lives and his own. Welcome, Mark.
Alan, it's good to talk to you.
Thank you. Now, can you please just start by giving us a bit of your background, where you were born, grew up, went to school, and so on?
Well, I was born in Lower Merion, Pennsylvania. My parents were living in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania at the time, which is where they met. My father had graduated a year earlier. He was the only black male student at Swarthmore in his class. And my mother was a French professor at Swarthmore. And they had met when my mother helped the students put on a play in French, and they were looking for somebody to play a tribal chieftain. And my father's roommate suggested my father, even though he didn't speak French, and my mother had to tutor him and so he could learn his lines. And in the course of it, he fell in love with her, and they started seeing each other. And because it was an interracial romance and also student-teacher romance, they had to carry on in private for a year and a half before he graduated. And they got married the summer after he graduated, and then I was born a little bit more than a year after that. And my early years were spent following my parents around as they did research, and also in their early academic jobs. So we lived in Swarthmore, and then we spent a year living in England and Nigeria. My father became a scholar of African politics. Then we lived in Princeton for a year, where he was working on his doctoral thesis. And then we moved to Los Angeles, where he had got his first tenure-track job at UCLA. But it was during 2 years in Los Angeles that my parents split up, and we eventually, my younger brother and I, came back to the East Coast with my mother. First we lived in Swarthmore again for a year, and then moved to Massachusetts, where she finally, after years, she had given up her tenure job at Swarthmore to follow my father. When he asked for a divorce, she couldn't get a full-time job. She worked as a substitute teacher in high schools and in community colleges for several years, finally got a full-time job at a little, what was then a women's college in south of Boston called Wheaton College, and we moved there when I was about to turn 8 years old. And I lived there until I started to go away to school in high school and then in college. So those are the circumstances, but the story of the book is not just what happened to us in terms of where we lived, but who my parents were, how they fell in love, where they came from, and then what happened to all of us during the marriage, but then after it all broke up.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And when did you decide to write the book, and why?
Well, for a long time, people who had heard some of the story about my parents told me they thought it might be a book someday. So my father had grown up in black Pittsburgh, and both of his parents were undertakers. So he literally grew up above a funeral home. My grandfather may have been the first black undertaker in Pittsburgh. He had been born on a tenant farm in Texas in 1898, the 13th son of a former slave, and educated only through the seventh grade, had made his way north to Pittsburgh as part of the Great Black Migration, started working in the steel plants, as a manual laborer, and as a side job, got a job driving, chauffeuring the owner of a white owner of a funeral home in Pittsburgh, who, as more and more black people moved into Pittsburgh, decided that he didn't want to have to bury black people because it would be bad for his business. So he offered to set my granddad up in business as a mortician. So my father came from this world that I call a cross between August Wilson and Six Feet Under. Meanwhile, my mother had come to America in 1940 when she was 14 years old from Nazi-occupied France with five younger sisters. She was one of eight sisters, so six of them came over and were placed with American families during the war. Meanwhile, my grandfather, who was a French Protestant pastor in a little village in the mountains of central France, he and the other pastor there organized this village to become an underground railroad for Jews who were hiding from the Nazis during the war. And ultimately, they helped hide thousands of Jews from the Nazis and the Vichy police. The town was called Le Chambon-sur-Mignon, became a famous story. There were books and movies that were done about their heroism. And so both of them had these fascinating backgrounds, their marriage, the circumstances of how they met. My mother was almost denied tenure at Swarthmore. Civil rights leaders, Bayard Rustin and others, got involved. Our early adventures, all of that was very sort of romantic and interesting, and people would say, well, that could be a book. What I didn't talk about was what happened after they got divorced. My father became a chronic alcoholic. My mother struggled with depression. I became obese. Eventually, we all worked our way out of that. You know, I wasn't sure that I really wanted to write about that part of it. Then my father died in right after Thanksgiving, 2008. And Thanksgiving is a big thing. Many dramatic things happen in this book around Thanksgivings. But one of them was that finally he died. I thought, well, you know, so much forever writing a book. And then a year later, to the day, to the hour, he died in the middle of the night on the Saturday after Thanksgiving. A year later, on the Saturday after Thanksgiving, in the middle of the night, I woke up and just with this epiphany that I wanted to try to write this book. And that's how I started writing. And initially, I thought, you know, and I had never written a memoir. I thought, well, you know, you write memoirs from memory. So I started writing just from memory. And once I had sort of a rough chapter, I realized that there were a lot of things that I didn't know, or I thought I knew, but I wasn't entirely sure. And because I had been trained for 30 years to be a reporter, I said, what I need to do is do some reporting here. So I started, I got in touch with, you know, all of the people who had lived through the events, my father's college roommate, my mother, obviously, other women my father had been involved in, academic colleagues, people who had known them at the time. I started interviewing, I started collecting letters, diaries. So the book ultimately is a book both of memory, but also of reporting and of told from the advantage of someone comparing what I experienced at the time and remembered with what I found out to be the truth in the course of reporting.
That's wonderful. And so what were your biggest challenges and discoveries during the whole process?
Well, you know, there's always a challenge in getting people to talk about events like these. I mean, in a lot of cases, the people I got in contact told me they had forgotten, they didn't remember. I said, well, let me come and talk to you anyway. And I would always, because a lot of them were elderly, I would always make sure that I began our interviews early in the day when I figured they'd have more energy, and also to make sure that they didn't have anything, commitments that they had to run to, so that if we really got going, we wouldn't be interrupted. And it turned out I was that once we got going, they remembered a lot. You know, I was people have asked me, well, how did you get them to talk about all of these, sensitive issues and things they might have been embarrassed by? And I think, you know, this is where my training as a journalist, I think, came in handy. I was very non-judgmental about in my interviewing. I didn't come at these interviews from the point of view of why did you do this to me, or why didn't you tell me this at the time, or why did you hurt that person or this person. I really tried to be very, you know, detached and objective, and to lead them through the events without, you know, reacting emotionally. And even though a lot of these events had an impact on me as a child, and I think once they saw that I was just interested in finding out what really happened and not in assigning blame or picking heroes and villains, I think they became much more willing to talk to me. And then once I started asking them for letters and diaries, again, in a lot of cases they said, well, I don't know if I've kept any of these things, and then they go look for them and they'd find some things had been destroyed, but a lot of things thankfully had been kept. And there were a lot of clues to things that even they had forgotten, but once I saw it in the letters, I went back to them and I said, well, what happened there? What did that mean? And then that jogged their memory. I think sort of how to approach it in a way that would actually get people to talk and to remember was probably the biggest challenge. The discoveries, you know, there were so – first of all, I discovered a lot of things that I thought were the case that I was wrong about. But then there were other things that I discovered that I had never known about. For example, my grandfather, my father's father, who had suffered a stroke when I was 3 or 4 years old. So my memories of him are this man who was in a wheelchair and half paralyzed and talked with great difficulty. You know, I discovered in the course of my reporting what an incredible force of nature was. This guy who had born on a tenant farm and, you know, had become this successful businessman in Pittsburgh, and, you know, it turns out he was a real ladies' man too, and, you know, kind of very attractive to a lot of people. And who he had ultimately had a very difficult relationship with my father, which I think is a key to a lot of my father's demons. But among other things, when I was interviewing my aunt, my father had three older sisters, and only one of them is still living. And in the course of a long interview with her and her husband, he said, my Uncle Gene, in the middle of this interview, said, you know, and we started talking about my granddad, and he said, you know, he wrote an autobiography. And I said, well, what are you talking about? He said, well, I'll go find it. Anyway, it turned out that this was, he searched around and found in a drawer someplace an 11-page document that my grandfather had written on his 75th birthday, and it was very neatly typed, so I'm sure he didn't write it himself, but, you know, he wouldn't have physically been able to given his stroke. So he probably dictated it to a nurse in the retirement home, the nursing home where he lived. Anyway, but it has all of these accounts of who his father was, who his parents were, what it was like to grow up, you know, in Texas, you know, how he had made his way to Pittsburgh, the kind of racism that he had encountered in the steel plants when he first arrived at Pittsburgh. And, you know, there were other stories that I discovered. I discovered exactly what had come between my parents, why they had gotten divorced, what the financial struggles that they had had over the years. My father had been hired at one point as the head of the first African-American studies program at Princeton. He came back to the East Coast from UCLA 5 or 6 years after my parents divorced to take this job. Very prestigious appointment, and he lost the job within 3 years because of his alcoholism. Anyway, I discovered all of the details behind that, how that had happened. There was a legal case that he got involved with later with Brooklyn College, where he sued them for discrimination. It became sort of a nationally covered and famous case, basically arguing that alcoholism was a physical disability. And, you know, I went through all the court records of that trial. So a lot of things that, I think would be fascinating, you know, even if they weren't part of my personal story, but that I reconstruct through all of this research that I did.
Very good. And then in the title, when you say my long trip home, where is home for you?
Well, my long trip home is sort of has a double meaning. One of it is as anybody who reads the book or listens to the book will hear. My childhood involved many, many long trips, often to new homes. I think that by the time I turned 8, I had moved, I think, every single year to a new place at the beginning of the year, often to places where I didn't know anybody. My birthday is September 7th, so I was always celebrating my birthday at a new place with nobody there, to no friends to invite to a birthday party. And I talk about these trips and kind of, you know, how emotionally difficult a lot of them were as a child. But the my long trip home also describes the journey I took in writing this book. After an adult life where, you know, I sort of thought of myself as constructing a life in my career and in my personal life, my marriage as a father, where I was doing everything that my parents hadn't done for me, and figuring it out on my own. And what I discovered in the journey, in the long trip of writing this book and researching this book, is how much not only the was I relying on the good things that I got from my parents and from my grandparents, and the not just, you know, running away from the bad examples, but drawing on this kind of tradition of scholarship and of resilience and of pioneering that had been in my family on both sides for generations. So it's a long trip home that leads ultimately to this acceptance and understanding and forgiveness of my parents and a better understanding of myself. So that's the long trip as well.
Very good. And now, of course, your book is an audiobook narrated by Robertson Dean. I understand that you had some communication with him and that you've heard some of the audiobook. Can you tell us just what your feelings are?
First of all, he was I was kindly given a number of choices for who the narrator would be, and I listened to them, and I was very taken by him, and I thought, you know, he would be the perfect narrator for the story. And then he lives out on the West Coast, but in the course of doing the recording the book, he called me several times, partly because he was, you know, taken by the book and wanted to talk about some of the characters, but also to make sure that he got some of the pronunciations right. My mother's family is French, and he wanted to make sure that all the French pronunciations were correct. But, you know, so we sort of got to know each other by phone that way, and, you know, he's a very nice guy. But I was just very touched because he kept saying, you know, I know I'm doing this professionally, but I'm just so taken with this story, and it strikes me. And he had the reaction that a lot of people have had to the book, which is, you know, they sort of see the cover and it's a picture of me when I was 5 years old, sitting between my parents on my grandmother's couch in Pittsburgh, and you know, my white, very light skinned mother and my black father, and you know, they think it's going to be a story that's about racial identity and, you know, sort of shades of dreams from my father and Barack Obama and so forth. And there's a lot about my, you know, my racial heritage and on both sides, and my own kind of struggles with identity in the book. But it's much more a story ultimately about family and about relationships within families that that I think anybody, no matter what your racial background is, can relate to. And that's what Rob kept saying, is, you know, I mean, you know, you know, that he related to the family element of the story. So, you know, I hope other people will, and you know, I think he's done a terrific job of really conveying that in an emotional way, in a compelling way in his narrative.
Well, thank you so much, Mark Whitaker, author of My Long Trip Home, a family memoir, now an audiobook available on Tantor.com. This is Alan Hoving.
Thanks so much, and hope everybody enjoys it.